Hello, everybody. This is Crosstown Conversations. I'm your host, Jean Nathan, and I have a very special guest with me today. He's been on occasion with a few words, but now we're doing a kind of focus on him because he and Frank Gehry, someone he's worked with over the years, have a joint show opening on April 13th. That's the Sunday after this
Saturday.
I'm sorry. After this Saturday. And it's a very interesting show because these are two very original and creative artists. There's all kinds of art being made by all kinds of people, but one of the most important forms of art is original, where the ideas are new. And that's what both of these artists and architects in Frank's case and planner in Bob Tannen's case, that's what they're all about. So we're going to do a little sort of history tracing on how both of them have developed their focus. We should have Frank on soon and Tannen today. So let's start with the beginning, which is Coney Island.
My parents decided to rent a beachfront apartment in a private community, Seagate on Coney Island, and to provide little Bobby with a big sandbox, the Atlantic Ocean, and Coney Island beaches. So that became my initial place to develop thoughts and work as an artist, working with mud and with materials that floated up from the Atlantic as well as down the Hudson and the East River. So I had this private sandbox that was quite large.
It wasn't so private because a lot of people could get on the beaches there,
correct,
right?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah, but it was private in the sense that I was able to spend a great deal of time there, more than most people, since it was only 300 feet away from our apartment. And I spent as many hours on the beach as I could, working with materials that floated up or floated down, as the case may be.
When you first started doing that, what were you thinking? Picking up trash on the beach and making sculpture out of it.
Started with mud cities. Many people do that, building mud cities.
Right.
And so that gave me the regional context of creating mud cities on the ocean. And these beaches had huge quantities of debris that had floated downriver from shipyards and other places on the East and Hudson River, and also came in with the tides on the Atlantic Ocean. So I had huge materials to work with, large and small. And it helped me develop a sense of trying to relate this huge environment to the materials that I was working with.
And
that was very fortuitous.
Because?
My parents renting this apartment near the beach.
Right.
And I think it had a lot to do with my mother's interest in the beach. And she was an artist. And she and I worked together doing watercolors on the beach as well.
So you were pretty young, right? How old were you when you first started doing that?
Probably five or six, maybe younger. I was also going to an art school in Manhattan, a communist art school, the Jefferson School, where I studied sculpture beginning at the age of 7. But the beach was the principal place that helped me develop ideas that would continue on into adulthood.
So pretty soon, from what I recall from conversations over the years, you wind up on 10th Street, which was then the main art corridor in New York. let's say at least the more avant-garde arts corridor, with these works that you had pulled together from the ocean and the river on the beach. And that was young. How old were you when you?
My father had a bookstore on 9th Street and 10th Street and on Park Avenue South, which was then 4th Avenue, around the corner from many of these co-op galleries where many of the abstract expressionists and others exhibited. And I became aware at an early age of what was going on 10th Street. And soon enough, I made the acquaintance of Mark DeSubro, who was a recent arrival from California. And he and I became members of the March Gallery. We exhibited there for a couple of years. And then there were other galleries that we also exhibited in. But that was the beginning of connecting my experience on the beach with bringing materials from the beach to the galleries.
What was the reaction to your work at that time? Because I think you were pretty much the first person who was showing that kind of sourced material from the streets, so to speak, in this case,
Well, I
beaches.
wasn't the only one. Mark DeSubro and I together and separately work with materials that his early work involved timbers, and so did mine. We worked together and separately, developing a relationship which we maintained for many, many years. Mark was probably my closest artist friend in that period, and we are still to this day communicating with each other.
Then, as I recall, when you hit 10th Street, not only are you interacting with Mark DeSouvreau, but you're interacting with a lot of other of the
Yes.
artists of that day who became important leaders in the American art movement,
Yes.
which again was original. It's focused on very
So
original
this
work.
was a second fortuitousness, the first being my parents renting an apartment on the beach, on a private beach on the Atlantic Ocean, and my father having a bookshop, a secondhand and rare bookshop around the corner where there were many galleries, some co-ops and some professional maintained by staff. So those two fortuitous occurrences really helped form my future interest and development.
Then you're a teenager, so not totally surprising, especially for that era, and unfortunately, maybe for the coming era, you generated a child. And that,
More than one.
right, and that opened up a whole new, channel for
Yes.
you in that you had to go to work
But that
and
was fortuitous also. I was fishing on, I had a studio on the corner of 48th Street and the ocean, which gave me a place to store materials. And that was very close to where Barbara Aurans lived. And we became close, and soon after two babies, we moved up to New Hampshire, where I had an opportunity to become part of a team to create Franconia College. And
that's kind of cheeky
after
for
two
a
years,
teenager, basically. I think if I recall correctly, you were 19, to think that you could start a college.
well, I was older than 19, but still, I was part of a team of about six or seven people to take over an old hotel in the White Mountains that had previously been a part of a school, but not a college. It was a high school, a boarding school, and we started within 1 year. We had a curriculum, we had faculty, we had students, and I continued there for 2 years. The faculty had recommended me to be president, but the board of the school, made up mostly of people from Northern New Hampshire, didn't think
it was a Jewish boy from Brooklyn the right
guy. Actually, the chairman of the board said that this was the year Kennedy was killed. He said, this is not a good year for a Catholic president, and it's probably not a good year for a Jewish president as well. So I left there, and another fortuitous move was to Cambridge and meeting Bill Wainwright of Geometrics Incorporated, the company that was working with Buckminster Fuller on geodesic structures around the world. And Bill Wainwright and I became good friends, and he had another friend, Charlie Butcher, who had created the Lazy Eight, a research and development company. Buckminster Fuller was a member, and others who were well known. So the series of fortuitous opportunities helped form my adult life as an artist and also as a regional planner. I became much more interested. William Katavlis, who was my mentor at Pratt, who did one of the first floating cities that was part of an exhibit at Museum of Modern Art at that period. He made it clear that we need to be thinking more creatively and about cities, not just to improve existing cities, but to create cities using new resources. In his case, he had recommended a floating city, and Buckminster Fuller also had floating cities that he was promoting. So there was a series of fortuitous events in my life before I was 25 or so that helped form pretty much what I'm still doing today.
And that involves reflecting in your artwork, but also in your thinking and in your planning practice, a special commitment to the relationship between land and water. I mean, this is today something that our artists are, many of them, focused on, and we're all talking about. we're talking, in your case, that was back in the late 50s, early 60s, and it became a part of your art and work practice, which is also true for Frank Gehry. He had, I don't know where he lived as a
Toronto.
I'll find out. No, I know which city, but how close to the water. But he definitely had a similar kind of affinity and interest in it. And that evolves later in later years to a relationship between the two of you on your work. But before we get that far along, because I don't want to go forever on the old years, but I do have to note the chutzpah of this just barely out of his teen years father, thinking sort of beyond his own area of interest and doing something like a class on Marilyn Monroe. That sort of sticks
that,
in
that
my
was at Franconia.
Yeah, that sticks in my mind as kind of a crazy thing, but I'm curious to know where that came from, what that was all about, and how would you place that on this list of events that helped shape
who you are? Well, we're going back and forth. That was in Franconia College, where I had left and moved to Cambridge, and again met up with a group of people at Harvard and MIT. And in the community of Cambridge.
But before that, you do this course.
Well, the course was in Franconia.
I know, but I'm just, it's always
the idea was Frank, you know, Marilyn Monroe is this ambiguous figure, a sexy woman on the one hand, but a brilliant comedian on the other hand, very, very bright. And so we did a series of her films as part of a curriculum at Franconia. But I'm already here now talking about Cambridge. Cambridge offered the opportunity to work in regional planning as well as in art. And so we were part of, or I was a part of, our family was a part of a community in Cambridge, a very broad group of people, Bill Wainwright, Clara Mack, Charles Butcher, who founded the Lazy Eight. And I was offered the opportunity to manage this organization, the Lazy Eight, which was a thinkers and inventors company that would take ideas from its members and create products that could either be sold or somehow enter the marketplace. So that period was maybe a 2 year adventure. But in the course of that, I met Bob Burden, who was a professor of environmental engineering at Harvard and had a company called Meta Systems. And Bob also was the father of Chris Burden, the artist. And so Bob had a strong arts orientation himself. And he and I began to think about working in places like the South. And then again, fortuitously, unfortunately, there was this super hurricane, Camille, in 1969. And Bob's firm, Meta Systems, was able to retain a contract with the state of Mississippi to plan the redevelopment of six coastal parishes in Mississippi that had been devastated by Camille. Camille, one of the most powerful and costly storms on record. And Bob had the contract, and he sent Mel King, who was then the head of the Urban League in Boston, and myself to Mississippi to kind of do the on the what would you call it? Make contact with people in the communities, make contact with elected officials.
Community engagement, yeah.
And we, Mel worked the black community, I worked the white community, and we would meet in the evenings and compare notes. That turned into a much longer effort on my part. I moved into Pastor Stan and continued to work with many of the people that were part of the study to rebuild the coast. And in my case, I found that living in Pastor Stan was another fortuitous opportunity, as a young person on the beach of Coney Island. In the case of Pastor Stan, the Gulf of Mexico, U.S. Gulf of Mexico, includes five states from Florida to Texas, and it occurred to me that the Gulf of Mexico was a place that had to be better understood in the context of long-term opportunities for people to live there or to migrate away if they were already living there. We were aware that future storms, very early on, future storms would be more powerful, and many of the low-lying counties and parishes, including Louisiana, were not suitable for long-term human habitation.
So, you do that effort, you do the plan for the redevelopment of the Gulf Coast. In the meantime,
Under the auspices of Meta Systems,
right. But in the meantime, and by the way, you mentioned Mel King, who became a lifelong friend that you worked with in other instances, and unfortunately just recently passed, and we miss him a lot. And in the meantime, somebody named Ronnie Katz is the state planning director for Louisiana, and he apparently had been paying attention to what you and Mel and others were doing on the Gulf Coast, contacted you about a project in New Orleans that was sitting on a desk and just not moving because the state had this idea of putting a second bridge in New Orleans across Napoleon Avenue. That, of course, was a non-starter. People in uptown New Orleans were not having that. Preservationists from all over the city were not having that. So you get together with another guy.
Well,
There's always this theme
Ron
of
Price,
collaboration
yeah.
with you in your
Well,
work.
Ron Katz was a very special person. He was a Harvard-educated architect who was part of a group in New Orleans concerned with the preservation of the city. And Ron convinced Senator O'Keefe, who was the head of the state Senate, his mentor, that there could be a comprehensive study done with federal funding to deal not only with bridges, but with mass transit across the river, and as well as maybe not having another bridge, a no bridge alternative, let's call it. So Ron hired me, and also there were two of us in charge of this effort. I think it was $250,000 of state money that Ron was able to get from the legislature to do the study. And Michael Dobbins, who was a Yale-trained architect, and I were the two leads for this study. Michael being the technical director, in my case being the project manager, which became a relationship continuing forward for many years.
To this
So,
day, yeah.
and so we did that first study, looking at all options, not committed to a bridge, but trying to determine best ways to cross the river, a transit bridge or a transit-only bridge or a no bridge. All of these opportunities were examined. But this was also in 69 and 70s when the Environmental Policy Act was passed and became a major change in the way federal funds were used for transportation projects. Here's another fortuitous accidental person that entered our life. There was a man who worked for the Nixon administration in charge of planning for the Federal Highway Administration named Richard Bouchard. And Richard Bouchard came to New Orleans with a lot of money in his pocket to do this study. But he also provided guidance, very creative guidance on how the work should be done. And Richard also had great future beyond the Nixon administration. He became one of the founders of AECOM, now the largest engineering company in the world. He and Dick Newman together. And Dick Newman was another person that I met in the course. So there are these accidental meetings that moved my career, let's say, to new territory, new opportunities.
Well, let's get to the other part of your life that is the subject to a great extent of the exhibition that's opening on the 13th of April in Biloxi at the O'Keeffe Museum, which is another kind of fortuitous development, of course. But what happens is that all this time, you are fundamentally an artist, even though you are also fundamentally a planner. And so you're working on these big projects that will determine how certain regions develop. But you're also making art, and each is influencing the other. And that is also typical in Frank Gehry's case. And we'll learn more about that when we talk with him. But I need to understand how you balanced these two completely different disciplines of making art and planning cities and regions. So
well, starts,
how did that work?
It starts with having to make a living. So I first met Arthur Davis of Curtis and Davis when we were looking for a firm, a local firm in Louisiana, to work with on the federal funding of the bridge study. And so I became head of planning for Curtis and Davis. And that work continued to new funding. And Bouchard was very instrumental in providing the mentoring and the politics. He was brilliant. He was dealing with very conservative legislators and governments, but also had a very very liberal, let's call it, view of the planning discipline.
So let me just I've got to get into the weaving of your artwork with this, and I appreciate. And also, it's interesting that I have to say Bouchard certainly had his sensitivity and appreciation of art along the way. But I just need to understand, because I think a lot of creative people, whatever their practice, have difficulty balancing that creative capacity and instinct and urge with a practice that generates income for their family. So I want to understand how you wove those two very different disciplines together.
Well, Dick Bouchard suggested that I should meet with Tony, there were several Tonys in my life. At
Mumfrey?
No, Tony. Tony, the head of Frederick R. Harris.
Posh.
Tony Posh. Okay, Tony Posh. So I met with Tony Posh, which he ran a major engineering company, Frederick R. Harris. And I began to work with Frederick R. Harris, again, expanding planning opportunities there. So I've always been working. After I left Curtis and Davis, I spent the rest of my 50-year career working with engineering companies, Frederick R. Harris, and then DimJim, and then DimJim Harris, and then finally AECOM, which is
well,
now the largest.
Well, finally now, of course, you're with.
So, but I, by having this engineering focus to my daytime job, and doing art at night and on weekends, there was still an opportunity. Fortuitous again, to work with engineers and an engineering firm after leaving Curtis and Davis for many, many years, and which made it provided income for my family, but also helped formulate this multidisciplinary approach to my life's work, which is a combination of art and regional planning and having relationships with engineers and architects. Frank Gehry enters the picture fortuitously. He had a contract in New Orleans to design a brown bag concert stage in Lafayette Square. And he came up with the idea of a glass stage that would disappear among the trees. And the preservation community and neighbors and Mayor Dutch Moriel were not pleased with that design. And I was asked by the mayor, Morial, to see if I could intercede and see if Gehry might do something different from the glass stage.
What didn't they like about the glass stage?
Well, the
danger
idea
of glass,
whatever it was, it just sounded weird to them.
Okay.
And well, so I didn't speak to Frank about this, but I loved the design myself. So I was an advocate on the one hand and trying to make peace with the mayor and with Frank together. That didn't work out. Frank decided not to go forward with the project. And we had another experience like that with the amphitheater during World War, I mean, sorry, during Expo 84, the World's Fair. So Frank and I became long-term collaborators and proposers and advocates and critics over many years. And so at one point, Frank Gehry asked Gene and I if we would go down to Panama, where his wife was from, to find a site for a new bio-environmental museum. Frank's wife, Berta, has family in Panama. And so we actually had a contract with Gehry's firm to identify alternative sites for this new museum, and also to help local elected officials navigate the process of funding a major museum in Panama.
So this explains your work with an arts institution, but you have not answered my question yet about how you balance the practice of art making, which you had continued to do and exhibiting your work at various museums, with that engineering practice. What you really did with the engineering companies was help them negotiate and understand the context of the environment that they were working in. That's something that
And
you've been a specialist.
multidisciplinary projects, multidisciplinary
All
projects,
right.
which became a way to not only introduce art and engineering and architecture, but to have them inform each other in my work, in Frank's work, and the work of other people. Mike Dobbins went on to become the chief planner in Atlanta during the Olympics. And so Mike and I have an ongoing relationship dealing with
So I know,
public projects.
I know that these are relationships that you have developed over the years are one major factor that facilitated your work, especially on behalf of the engineering companies, because you're working with, in many cases, fairly conservative folks who don't think a lot about art. So you're channeling your relationships with people to serve that part of your life.
But also
But
multidisciplinary planning was not very popular with many of our clients, particularly in the South, where the governments we were dealing with were quite conservative.
so I still am searching for the answer to my question about the balancing of your artwork with your engineering practice during the day. So, because I want to get to what's going to be on view at the museum, the Orr O'Keeffe Museum in Biloxi, which a lot of people don't know about. I mean, it always surprises me when I say Orr O'Keeffe Museum in Biloxi to somebody in New Orleans and they say, what, where, who? It's a spectacular museum. It wound up being designed by Frank Gehry.
Based on upon plans that you and I developed with people in
Yeah,
Biloxi.
I want to say that the citizens of Biloxi that were involved in the formation of that museum were highly involved in its development and its design and its conceptualization. So that's one of your skills that transfers between the arts and engineering is this ability to build relationships with people, regardless of what their political persuasions might be. I mean, you're kind of like an arty Biden in trying to open those doors and keep them open. But I really want to focus on your artwork because there's a lot of it on view at the Orr O'Keeffe Museum right now. This show of your work and Frank Gehry's work and your work together is an unusual focus for an art show. It's not typical. It's more typical as groups of artists and individuals, but pairing two artists with multidisciplinary talents and interests is not typical. So this is a very exceptional exhibition that I think is really important for people to see. And I really feel that people who have these persuasions, both creative and a particular practice, would benefit from you explaining how you were able to work in those two worlds, because I think a lot of us are afraid to cross that boundary from something as straight as engineering to something as fluid and unpredictable as art.
Well, in the case
so
of
I want you to help people, other people who have that capacity, to see how they can do that too.
Much of the relationship that I have with Frank is being able to discuss projects and proposals, few of which we were able to bring to fruition.
A few.
For example, during the World's Fair, Frank came up with a wonderful plan for an amphitheater, which had a fish scale roof. And the fish scale roof was eliminated because of, as I understood, it was questions of cost. And Frank essentially removed himself from the project because of that.
But he had already essentially designed the infrastructure for that. I mean, that's a facility that's close to my heart because I worked for the World's Fair, and there was absolutely nothing at the fair more spectacular than sitting in the bleachers, so to speak, and sitting at the amphitheater and watching Julio Iglesias on the stage, and behind him, tugboats and steamboats and barges are passing while the moon's rising. I mean, it was just spectacular, and it's unfortunate that for reasons that really never made any sense, it came down. But
well, I had a relationship, again, fortuitous. The World's Fair, Expo 84, had an opportunity to develop residual uses of the fair improvements, which I was able to bring the Rouse Corporation to the table to invest in the World's Fair, $50 million of their own money, on the assumption that they will then have the use of part of the fair site after the fair. And so this was an example of where a residual use, let's call it, was laid out in advance of the fair, where the Rouse Company, and I believe this has happened elsewhere with other World's Fairs, but the Rouse Company put its money on the table to invest in the fair with a contract that they would then have a project called Riverwalk post-fair, which was a major festival marketplace like others in the country. So we had that opportunity, as well as working with Jerry Dirks and Con Demas. We tried to put together deals for
the Italian Village.
Well, not only the Italian Village, but developed using the amphitheater or the
plaza,
the space of the International Pavilions for a cruise terminal, subject to the port's interest in having a cruise terminal there. So there was a lot of wonderful things that grew out of the fair. People often refer to the fair as being a disaster. Well, it was not a disaster. It created a new neighborhood. It made it possible to have a major cruise terminal on the residual side of the fair. So it was beneficial to the region, and continues to be beneficial to the region. So we're going back and forth on a number of projects, but the key in all of this, and in Frank's work as well, is having a conversation about a large-scaled project in the context of whether it's on the West Coast or the South Coast or the East Coast, of the kind of things that Frank and I have been doing together. And this exhibit will include Many of the plans and models and objects associated with our collaboration. But our collaboration needs to be understood clearly. Frank, other than the museum in Panama, most of our collaboration was discussion. We discussed projects. We wrote letters. We tried to get Bill Clinton to hire Frank Gehry to do his library. And Bill's response was, well, Frank's work is for the ages. Well, if it's for the ages, why did he not use Frank as the architect for his library?
Somebody conservative in his staff couldn't quite make that.
But
leap.
I think this exhibit will demonstrate the multidisciplinary characteristic of Frank's work and my work. And so we show how we share ideas and share a friendship and kind of a brotherhood in a certain way with projects he's doing, projects I'm doing, and conversations that we've had between each other for the last 40 years.
So speaking of sharing these interests, there is a couple other specifics I want to talk about. I want to talk about the fish. I mean, you told me yesterday for the first time that you spent many nights sitting on the rocks on Coney Island, fly fishing, which wasn't necessarily
not
that.
Fly fishing. No, it was. It was surf casting.
Surf casting. What's the difference between
surf casting? Surf casting from my studio, which was the beach, out to where the striped bass and the bluefish were.
Okay, so you've got that connection, and then you actually do some art about fishes.
Yeah.
And Frank, pretty soon after, he had seen some of your work, but he had his own. Background in dealing with fish, and I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it was again.
Well, I can tell you what it was. What he suggested to me was that his grandmother in Canada, in Toronto, introduced him to
goldfish.
No, to a fish dish that's very popular in among Jewish populations, gefilte fish, and he became interested in the fish idea. Separate and developed many wonderful fish products and still does. And I have done the same, focusing more on sculpture than the multiplicity of Frank's fish subjects.
But it was another track or path where you shared a similar interest. He went in a certain direction. You went in a certain direction. That's one thing that I wanted to bring some focus to. But I also want to better understand ultimately you wind up working with a company that deals with water issues, the company you're working with now.
Yeah,
and once again, there you are out on the water.
Well,
so CDM, to speak.
CDM Smith is a engineering company focused on water and wastewater and all of the associated water issues, as well as transportation and energy. And interesting, Dick Bouchard's son, Tony Bouchard, is the CEO of CDM Smith, and I'm still consulting with them.
And you can see, audience, that relationships are a very important part of the process of how, I call him Tannen for weird reasons. When I first met him, people were calling him Tannen, so I just never learned him as Bob. So there are people who call him Bob.
I was working with two other Bobs and we used our last names to not confuse each other.
I think that also there was a trail for you in dealing with other disciplines related to water that you have developed through working with CDM Smith, but at the same time you are also working with the housing implications of a disaster. So along comes Katrina, and one of the issues that arose during Katrina was how to house people who've lost their homes on an immediate basis. And the typical solution was trailers, and trailers have a big downside called pollution that is intrinsic in the process of the building of those. So you're looking for a solution to that, and you come up with a housing focus that eventually you invite Frank Carey to help you with. But start from the beginning. Where did the idea of the so-called mod gun evolve in your mind?
The shotgun is a common form of architecture and housing throughout the South, and actually has antecedents in Africa and Greece, etc. So I began to focus, as part of the study that was done of New Orleans neighborhoods, we realized that the shotgun house was the ubiquitous form of housing in New Orleans and elsewhere in the Gulf Coast, including Biloxi. And so we then decided that that the shotgun house could be based upon a 14 by 14 foot room that could be used in a variety of ways. You start with one room post storm, let's say major hurricane. You start with one room, and you can, depending upon the resources and funding availability, you can then build more than one room if the funds are available. But you can start with a basic 14 by 14 foot modular unit that would be flexible to be used however which way it needs to be used.
And as I understand it, the shotgun house is called a shotgun house because one room backs up to another, backs up to another, backs up to another. And so you could literally shoot a gun and it's going to go right straight through the house. And so you're talking about being able to add those rooms on in a straight line, so to speak.
And we, in the course of a study we did for the city of New Orleans of housing and preservation of neighborhoods,
that was done under Curtis and Davis, right?
That was Curtis and Davis, yeah. With Arthur Davis and Buster Curtis. But we realized when studying shotgun houses that many people had added to their shotguns behind them, if they had land to expand their shotgun, it would be in this linear form. Right, so the idea was something that was already there in the development of housing on the Gulf Coast.
But that also, I just remembered, isn't that also a factor of a lot of linear layouts of housing in relationship to the Mississippi River? So you have a lot of houses whose orientation is on a narrow...
The land use plans in places along the river as well as on the coast
and the
was
bayous.
To have a long, narrow piece of ground or land so that the actual frontage on rivers and frontage on the Gulf Coast was the most valuable. So you had long, narrow lots characteristic in New Orleans and also on the Gulf Coast throughout the Gulf Coast from Florida to Texas and beyond.
Let me ask you, as we kind of near the end of my time frame, I think clearly the factors involved in the development of land, of relationships between land and water, and just the cultural depth of this region kept you from going back up east?
Well, they were fortuitously again, one development after another, kind of doors were opened or semi-opened, and rather than going back to the Northeast, which is now suffering from similar kind of issues that began in the South with major hurricanes. Once we had Hurricane Sandy, it became clear that hurricanes and intense storms are going to be with us in the future, and the entire country, and not only the U.S., but other countries on water, other countries on oceans, and on bays and rivers. We did this study at the as a part of a residency at the Rauschenberg studio in Florida, where I looked at, with the help of a wonderful artist named Matthew, excuse me, Matthew Foreman, we developed these plans looking at relative elevations where people could live safely or not. And that's part of this exhibit. I did a study of all 68 counties and parishes fronting on the Gulf of Mexico, from Florida to Texas. So that's part of the exhibit. So in a way, this exhibit weaves through Frank's experiences and weaves through my experiences, and the collaborations were more thinking than projects. We used projects as an example of proposals, as an example of advancing some ideas that we shared.
However, the mob gun, which again, you designed the initial idea for that based on the need that became clear after Katrina when so many people lost their homes. But then you invite Frank, who you recognize his architectural imagination and originality, to interpret your initial fairly fundamental design. And next thing you know, you have the Gary Tannen mod gun. And that is now on view in Past Christian, the first one finally, because business is not maybe your main focus. And it was hard to find modular alternatives. But next thing you know, you have a mod gun built on the Gulf Coast in Past Christian, now being lived in by the owners who commissioned it. And that thing is up on piers. How many feet high?
9 feet.
9 feet into the air. When you look out from the porches around it that were part of Frank Gehry's enhancement of your design, you're looking straight into the branches of big live oak trees facing the Gulf.
Well, Tina Freeman and Philip Woolham saw the model that the Gehry office had made of the mod gun with Frank's twist, so to speak. And Tina and Philip said, well, we'd like to have it. And there was minimum negotiations. They decided they wanted to have a mod gun with Gary's involvement, and it's there and will be part of this exhibit going forward. And I think that Tina and Philip were very creative in their own thinking about how to make that building livable for their own purposes. And so there are certain modifications that Tina and Philip wanted that also improve the final product. Please come to the Orr O'Keeffe Museum on April 13th from 10 till 5. Some of us will be there at different times as well. And give us an opportunity to hear your thoughts as well on this exhibit, which is unusual in that it's a collaboration. It's a joint effort with independent work and collaborations as part of it.
Thank you so much for all this time. This is a
Thank you.
longer interview than I usually do, and
Thank you.
I appreciate that you could handle actually having to talk to your wife in an interview for public air. So that's it, folks, for Crosstown Conversations this week. Now, next week we're going to have a part two with other people that were involved with this and are involved with the museum and Biloxi.
And hopefully an interview with Frank Gehry.
That's right. Okay. Thank you. Take care. Talk to you next time.